Welcome to This Business of Music and Poetry podcast, where the life of a creative meets the real world. I'm Michael Amade, host World Poetry Open Mic, The Michael Amade Show, author of more books than I should mention, musician, poet, and above all, creative entrepreneur. My collaborator and conspirator in this project is Clifford Brooks, founder of the Southern Collective Experience, host of Dante's Old South on NPR, poet and author of The Draw of Broken Eyes and Whirling Metaphysics, Exiles of Eden, and Athena Departs, The Gospel of a Man Apart. Our guest today is Cornelius Eady, who's the author of several books of poetry, including the critically acclaimed Hard-Headed Weather, which was nominated for a double ACP Image Award, Victims of the Latest Dance Craze, winner of the 1985 Lamont Prize from the Academy of American Poets, The Gathering of My Name, which was nominated for the 1992 Pulitzer Prize, and his most recent collection, The War Against the Obvious. With poet Toy Derek Coate, Eady is the founder of Cave Canem, a national organization for African American poetry and poets. He is a recipient of an NEA Fellowship in Literature, a John Simon Guggenheim Fellowship in Poetry, a Rockefeller Foundation Fellowship to Bellagio, Italy, and the Prairie Schooner Strauss Award. Without any further ado, here is our interview with Cornelius Eady.
Hello everyone, it's Michael from the show. I'm actually away from the studio right now, but I wanted to do an intro for a few pieces of music that we're going to hear during this episode. Now, before we get into the interview, we're going to start with a piece from Cornelius Eady's group called the Cornelius Eady Trio. This is a song called The Pickle King that was recorded during a rehearsal just with a camera, but I think it's a really fascinating song, and we're going to play it before we get into the interview. We'll find out more about him after.
Walking to the RFP, won't stop walking until I'm free. Gonna start walking to the RFP, won't stop walking until I'm free. Gonna stop working for Mr. Marmaduke. He gave my sweat to the railroad. The rails are iron, but they ain't chains. You'll never see my face again. Gonna stop walking to the RFP, won't stop walking until I'm free. Gonna stop walking till I am free. Won't stop walking until I'm free. Take that pickaxe and haul away. It gave my sweat to the railroad. My feet sprung wings and flew away. My feet will have a fantasy. Gonna stop walking till I am free. Won't stop walking until I'm free. Gonna stop walking till I am free. Won't stop walking until I'm free. Mama Duke calls me like a heart to a heart. He gave my sweat to the railroad. The Frederick Hall and the Virginia Land. The South lost a nigga, the North gave a man. Won't stop walking till the IFB. Won't stop walking until I'm free. Gonna stop walking till the IFB. Won't stop walking until I'm free. Got a $5 bounty upon my head. I took my sweat off the railroad. The rebels call me contraband. I'm gonna bring back the Union and raise this land. Gonna stop walking till the IFB. Won't stop walking until I'm free. Gonna stop walking till the IFB. Won't stop walking until I'm free. Gonna come back and get my wife. Gonna float like a ghost down the railroad. Go where I left her on the Duke's farm. Gonna feel like heaven when I take her home. Gonna stop walking till the IMP. Won't stop walking until I'm free. Gonna stop walking till the IMP. Won't stop walking until I'm free. My name's Sam Bolton and my story's true. I'm a union hero on the railroad. Who's got a fly and a free man sing. I'm the rich and happy as a pickle king. Gonna stop walking till the IFP. Won't stop walking until I'm free. Gonna stop walking till the IFP. Won't stop walking until I'm free.
Now, I know that you obviously are very prolific. You create a lot of things. Do you have a specific creative routine that you follow at any point during the day? And if so, what does that look like?
No, there isn't any. No, I mean, because the days are so varied between doing music and teaching and, you know, and writing. So there's no real set pattern. I usually look for days that, you know, whenever there's a moment to, I can concentrate. It's probably the best way of thinking about it. Looking for moments where you can actually concentrate and get started on something. Maybe not even finish it, but get the first stab at things, right? So, you know, that can be whenever, right? Yeah. There's no real schedule.
And I find that really fascinating. Do you find that the most important thing for you to do is just get started, or are you one of these people who start a bunch of things and then eventually maybe one out of 10 is the thing that you continue on and it really reaches fruition? Or once you start, is it pretty solid that you're going to finish? How do you think that works for you?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of both. I mean, there are things that I have projects that I work on, you know, periodically, you know, there's a couple of poetry cycles that I'm working on right now that I haven't finished, but I keep coming back to. Yeah, there's always something going on. That's really, I guess, what it is. You know, there's always something happening. I mean, I was just before you, you know, contacted me for the podcast, I was just rehearsing with my musicians, Charlie Rao and Lisa Liu, for another project that we're doing, not the Memphis project, but another project where I've set some of the poems by Sterling A. Brown, the African-American poet, to music. And that's going to be another project that we're going to start recording next week. So, you know, there's other things going on, you know, at the same time. And of course, in about 10 days, classes begin where I teach now. So, you know, just all these things are going on. You know, it's always a juggling thing, right? You're juggling a few things at a time.
See, that makes a lot of sense to me because I look at people who have amassed a large body of work over time. And more, that's the thing I respect the most. I respect momentum and time that people have spent, you know, over years doing it. And I've noticed people who've been doing it for quite a while and have built up this body of work. It almost feels casual when they talk about it. I do it when I have free time. But the reality is that takes discipline in itself, I can imagine. There's a lot of people with probably pockets of time just as much as you are, you know, but you're consistently moving and doing things. So I guess that leads me to kind of this origin story here. So how does a guy like you get started doing the stuff you're doing? And how does a guy like you, with the body of work you have now, how did you start?
I think all poets just sort of, different poets are different origin stories. I'm glad you're using the context of comic books. That's a nice way of putting it, right? The origin story of the superhero. But for me, I think it was just a curiosity that sort of stemmed from music and maybe lyrics into writing, poetry. And it was a slow thing. I mean, I'm glad you're right. I mean, you look back at a certain time and after a certain amount of time, and you accumulate a lot. And I think that's probably what you're talking about, stuff that accumulates over the years. And, and I've accumulated, I guess, enough.
You definitely have. That's a great thing. Right. Now, Cliff, you look like you have something you want to add in. I'll let you get a word in edgewise here.
Cornelius, what really strikes a chord with me, no pun intended here, is about how the transition from music, lyrics, and songwriting to poetry. My question to you is, where do you think that poetry and music meet? Where do you think that they marry in sound?
That's an interesting question. I often wonder about that. I was actually teaching a workshop in Florida this summer. And one of the people in the workshop was also a really great performance writer, good poet, but also performance too. And I think he's trying to explore that zone between the two things. They kept asking me something similar. I kept saying, well, why is that so important, right? You know,
right.
You know, I mean, why do you want to have the distinction between music and poetry as if one beats the other, or one is better than the other, or one's superior to the other. You know, it really, the I mean, they both have equal standing in the world. And I mean, it's one of those things where I don't quite get the tension. You know, I also told him, I think that, that since Bob Dylan got the Nobel Prize, that argument's done.
Right. Yes.
Some people out there may not like the, you know, the result, but that's what it is, right? It's, you know, it's now world literature, whether you like it or not, right? So, you know, I think that argument's been put, at least from my mind, I mean, that the argument's over. I mean, you don't have to worry about whether it's poetry or whether it's music or, or which one gets the upper hand. They both coexist in the world for different purposes. You know, and sometimes, you know, it's good to be able to have them operate the way they operate without having to be, to be merged with one another. I think a good poem, you know, really stands alone, can really stand alone without music. And I really agree, some really good lyrics. Can stand alone without music attached to it, but there's no reason for it to stand alone without music. I mean, you know, without melody to it. So for me, it's just a matter of what you want to do, right? Not what you need to prove. I think they're both there to be tapped into and used.
I think that's I think that's really valuable. There's been something I've been kind of realizing recently, and I came to poetry very much the same way you did, Cornelius, was writing and lyrics, and then it kind of naturally evolved. But the thing I'm starting to realize is it's more that the idea is the thing. You use the medium that's appropriate to communicate the idea. And I think, you know, and the other thing I've been realizing too is that a lot of times these authors, poets, musicians, a lot of times we write about the things we're chasing after. And, you know, it doesn't mean we're masters of something. It means we're chasing after it. Maybe we're running a little bit ahead of other people, but we're still running. And one thing I've been noticing quite a bit talking to aspiring poets and aspiring writers is they tend to really over intellectualize things like the difference between music and poetry, and they'll sit there and they'll have these big long discussions. I know you teach quite a bit. What is something that you feel a lot of younger poets or people who are desiring to live that poetic path, what are some things you see them getting hung up on? And I feel like there's a few of them that I see anyway, but maybe I'm mistaken. You would know better than I.
Well, maybe a way of putting that is that there's maybe an overemphasis on style over substance, perhaps sometimes.
Yeah.
That we really get so hung up on the mechanics of the poem, people can write really beautifully, technically exciting poems. And I'm not saying that one's better than the other. I don't want to get to a discussion where basically I'm trying to say one lords it over the other. But if you're talking about sometimes overemphasize things. I think that's one thing that gets overemphasized. We get so enamored of style, you know, that we forget, you know, at least that maybe or maybe it's incorrect. Perhaps I'm talking generationally because, you know, when I grew up, style, of course, craft is important, but it's not the end all. It's not the goal. Right. You know, it's about finding a way of describing experience. And and I think that's really what it is. The exploration of the experience is really the tantamount thing, you know, in the end. And sometimes I think that younger writers get distracted by that. They think that that is it. That they can just write the best Sestina. They can write the best sonic crown. That they can write the perfect villanelle. And then they've written them. Then they're really good poets, and they're really good technicians, not really great writers, you know. And I don't mean by that, but they're really great writers. I mean that they haven't done anything. They haven't really poured experience into it yet. Enough experience into it yet. And you have to. I think sometimes the idea of giving yourself some distance in order to figure out what you want to say, not just how to say, but what you want to say, could be something I noticed. Another thing that I noticed, of course, that which of course is problematic of just of the career of being a poet, is that now we feel we need more than publication. You know, we need awards. The book isn't any good unless somebody validates it with an award. The poetry isn't any good if the poet isn't pulling down, you know, medals from the shelves. It gets to be a little of show busy for me, to tell you the truth. You know, that's going to just be the era where. Passing through, when I was a poet, of course you want to have an audience, but it really wasn't about scoring medals, you know? That's one thing again. And again, not to put any casting aspersions on younger writers, because there's some fabulous younger writers out there. I don't want to make it sound like it's not us versus them. There's lots of poetry in the world. And it's also good to be able to know there's different poetry in the world. I sometimes wonder if again the idea of trying to get a certain kind of attention or fame by a certain age might not be a great way of trying to be a poet.
It certainly makes it competitive, doesn't it? And I remember, I don't know about you guys, but I was far more competitive in my early 20s.
Yeah, talking about because I'm older now, so it may not be. You know what I mean? You know, as I've said many times in workshop, you know, of course, to be a writer, you do have to be ambitious. You know, just the fact that the student has elected to go to the workshop, sort of reveals that the author has ambition. You know, they want to be out in the public, you know, so, and there's nothing wrong with that. That's not a sin. That's not a, you know, evil thing, you know,
absolutely,
to want. And, it commingles with a lot of things. Right. So I'm not, I don't want to sound like I'm being too like this stern guy things that these young, because of course I was that young person too. Right. And excuse me, wanted, attention, to the work. So,
of course, yeah. You want an audience that connects. I mean, you want to know you're creating things that are affecting people and connecting with people. I mean, that's
very normal.
Yeah, it's very normal. I was talking with someone yesterday about the rules of genre in different types of writing. And, you know, for a while, early on, I had kind of rebelled against this idea, you know, the artist part. I'm like, I don't want to be held by rules. You know how it goes. But at the same time, I was sitting there drinking a cup of coffee, and I was thinking, you know, in reality, if I go buy a book that's a thriller, it's like buying a cup of coffee. I want a warm drink that's going to, you know, but how we get there, the quality of the beans in the coffee, where it came from, the way it was all, you know, that's something. But when you're talking, I think you're talking about substance versus the style or the flash of it. It's like you could give me a normal cup of coffee in a pink coffee cup. That doesn't necessarily mean the cup of coffee is better. But if you take the time and figure out how to make it perfect, the right temperature, the right, you know, all that.
I get your point. I get your point. You're right. I mean, and there's, well, you know, there's also that, how can I put it? I mean, of course, You don't want to think that you are in the thrall of what came before you, right? That you are, you know, simply just you know, treading the same path as everyone else tread. You want to figure out a way of becoming individual, or be seen as an individual, and of course you sometimes some writers decide they need to experiment. I totally understand that, and also. There are sometimes political and historical reasons why you want to challenge that, right? But again, sometimes in workshop, I will tell the student, you know, to be prepared. You're really talking about who your audience is, your intended audience. If you're going to write something that's going to be very opaque and obscure, then you are aiming for the readers who like opaque and obscure work. You know, it's not going to be a general reader. They're not going to come running with you at you with Guggenheim. They're going to basically, you know, perhaps, you know, you basically have to understand that audience that general audience isn't trained to read the way you've trained yourself to read, and you're not, and so that audience isn't prepared to absorb it, you know, the way you want them to absorb it. They'd have to do a certain kind of training to understand it. So just by definition, you've already narrowed, you know, the idea of who your audience is going to be ever, right?
Absolutely. So yeah.
If you're truthful and you're saying this is the way I need to write, this is the only way I can do it, and this is the audience I'm trying to get into, fine. If not, then, you know, you can't expect the audience that hasn't been trained to read the way you've trained yourself to read to suddenly understand what you're up to, right? So for me, it's like that's an audience question, you know. It's where are you going to throw your hat in, right?
I think that's a valuable question that I, from what I see, a lot of writers have to learn to consider, right? I mean, yeah. It's obviously we want to do a good job. We want things that people are going to love to read. But a lot of times it's hard for us to sit there and go, who actually is going to read this? Who am I actually writing this for? What is their experience going to be? But it's such a valuable thing. And Cliff, I know that you spend a lot of time talking about that and kind of being involved in that thing. So I wonder if you have anything to add to this or anything you want to ask Cornelius? I feel like I'm monopolizing it again.
No. I'm sitting back. I preface it the same way that Cornelius did. Like I don't say any of this to be judgmental or to judge someone's work, but accessibility is, I think, the all. Like, I mean, unless you want to go more T.S. Eliot in his mid career that went, you know, and I love him, love his work, Wasteland, what's up? But there's a time where he got so into himself and look what languages I can speak that you don't, and look what books I've read that you haven't, that I still love it, but you have to, I don't love it as much. And you do have to go find those books and do that research. And it's not, on the other hand, I don't think speaking down to the populace, because brilliant work, I think, speaks to, to everybody.
Right. Yeah. You know? Exactly. Yeah.
And so, you know, there are, and going back, I mean, I almost wanted to jump out of my seat and scream amen, but, you know, I've heard so many people, now I won't say so many people, but I've heard people say, I love writing sonnets, or I love writing the Villanelle, I love writing Sestinas. And I would say, because I'm curious, like, well, why? You know, why? And then there's kind of some pushback. I'm like, well, look, I'm just what drew you to that form? And then they say, well, I'm good at that.
Yeah.
And I tread real carefully, because it's you can get the technical, this is just my opinion, you can get the technical side of things to a T, but unless you can imbue it with that thing, that fire that's in here, it reads like an instruction manual to a microwave.
Yeah.
You know, it is, yeah. And again, it's, yeah, like, and Cornelius, I love what you said about, like, because the hardest thing, because I can only speak from my experience, you know, when I've, of course, the same disillusionment, you know, when I was 21 and almost out of college, I was brooding because I thought, man, I should already have had a Pulitzer by now. You know, when you're young, you want it, you know, and then you live a couple of years and go, like, and you read that poetry going, oh God, that's so bad. I hope that never gets out. Let me burn that right now. Absolutely. You know, that was a blessing. But it's that getting mileage on you and getting something that you can actually talk about, and all of it's practice. But, you know, Cornelius, when it gave me peace when you said, you know, it's about the people, it's about the audience, it's not about the awards. And I firmly believe that when you put the audience first, it's more likely that those awards are going to come, because the award, you can't write to an award. You have to write for people.
Yeah.
You know, and so the accessibility, I think, has always been the all. And when I look at when you first sent me that song, I think it was over a year ago, you sent me a song. And the reason I've kind of touched on, you know, where poetry and music all touch, is that you've got this seamless harmony of it. And this is not to flatter. I think flattery is just the nicest way to lie. But, you know, that when I listen to your music, if someone asked me, so is that poetry or is that a song? I couldn't tell them, because it goes above that, you know. And when you said, like, you know, I don't see why people feel like they have to fight about, you know, is it this or is it that, you know, Bob Dylan, I had that award show that Bob Dylan winning. I'm like, well, of course he would. He's a poet. He wrote this song. But you had two camps that were like about to go fight.
Yeah.
You know, like, but I mean, I imagine that would be like a what was that when they did Romeo and Juliet, like West Side Story with Snap in it? Yeah. You know, not a real fight at all, you know.
Dance fighting, yeah.
He says, you know, come on this side of the street. But so I mean, from poetry now, and it's, do you feel like that it's in, that it's a important part of the education of a poet to dabble in all the different kind of forms just to get a feel for what's out there?
Yeah. I think for, especially for students, I think that's part of the, you know, part of the learning process is being able, and one of the great things about being in a writing program, I believe, is that if you're fortunate, you allow yourself to experiment, because it's, I've said many times, it's the best time to do that. There's no repercussions for anything you experiment with. You know, that you're not on the marketplace, you're not trying to get a teaching job. It's, you know, you're just going to be there for 2 years or 5 years if you're in a PhD program, and you can allow yourself to simply just figure out, well, these different forms of poetry, how they operate, what they do, what they don't do, what works for you, what doesn't work for you. And there's no repercussion. There's no downside for this. You know, deciding you're going to write Crown Science for 6 months won't get you, won't ruin your career. You know what I mean? because nobody's paying attention, to be quite honest about it. Right. So that invisibility is to your advantage. Right. You can figure all those muscles, and you can figure out what you want to use and discard what you don't think is very useful for you. So, it's good to have that kind of adventure, you know, through poetry. I think that's one of the great things about the MFA structure and PhD structure we've got right now, because it gives that student the opportunity if they're open to it. They can actually, you know, figure out a way of trying to figure out what their voice actually is about and who they think their audience might be, right? After they get out of that program.
Yeah. Now I do want to touch base on where you teach now and the chair you hold. Tell us about that.
Well, I don't hold a chair anymore. I'm not in Missouri anymore. Yes. Right. I did have an endowed chair at the University of Missouri. At Columbia, but right now I'm teaching at Stony Brook on Long Island in the MFA program, and this is my going into my third year there. Stony Brook is also be starting to just launched this year, last year I should say, a bachelor's in creative writing. You know, for undergrad, which I think was a brilliant idea, you know, so it's a small program, but really intense, you know, and the teaching staff there, Roger Rosenblatt works there, Amy Hempel just got hired there, Julie Sheehan, you know, is one of the, and Star Black are poets there. They also have a wonderful summer program, Southampton Arts, which is just a, your perfect summer camp, right?
Right.
Right, right, right. Because then Sharon Olds shows up and Billy Collins shows up and, you know, and you're out, you know, in the Hamptons and, you know, it's writing and it's a really, a fun program in a lot of ways. So, it's one of those programs where basically you get to see how some really strong students can become stronger by going through the mentorship out there.
I always like to ask people, especially in the art community, is the value of networking. And what drew me to you was this glow and excitement and the happiness. And even when you weren't being happy, the emotion was still genuine. The sharing nature of your work. I wonder if it go back to a core view of helping other people being important as a teacher, the usefulness of how does networking and being a teacher enrich your life?
Well, perhaps that's kind of the reflection of my upbringing, perhaps. I grew up in the 60s and 70s, and I think we had a sense of community there. Also, maybe perhaps the feeling that you were sort of responsible to sort of share the wealth, as they used to say, right? If you're in a position where you can actually help somebody else out, the feeling was that you do it. You know, you think of it more of a communal sense of everyone going forward, as opposed to trying to be a star all for yourself. So, I think that probably got drilled into me when I was a teenager, right? I do operate under that assumption. That right. if you actually get into a situation where you can actually help somebody else out, or allow someone to see themselves more or see the potential that you see in them, you try to steer them in that direction, right? If you see an opportunity where you could help somebody else in terms of just for example, saying, if a young writer could benefit from being in a workshop, and you know it's a workshop and it isn't your workshop necessarily, but you know the workshop is in town, and you know that person's really good, you might want to put a word in for that person, or for publications, or for things like that. And I mean, it's not unique to me, but I do think I do operate under those assumptions that everybody works out when everybody gets ahead. Now, rather than trying to think that it's all about, you know, how bright your star can shine on your own.
That makes a lot of sense. So, one thing was interesting is when Clifford said that you were going to be joining us, I instantly started kind of going back and thinking about it. And I realized that I had been exposed, really loved a piece by you, I'm a Fool to Love You, back in the early 2000s. And one of the things it reminded me of, and as I was kind of reading up and preparing for this, was your work in music. So if you're okay, the musician in me really wants to hear about this. So let's talk about the blues. Let's talk about jazz and some of the most American kind of music forms as they've come together anyway. I mean, elements, of course, from many places all over the world. Yeah. But you really explore some really incredible themes in your poetry. And I'm wondering, it must, I would imagine, continue to move forward into your musical work. So how did you move into the blues and into jazz, and how did you grow up as a musician into what you're doing now?
Well, it's like any kid who grew up in the 60s, you listen to a lot of radio. You hang out with a lot of friends. Your friends decide they want to start bands. You go into the bands with them. It usually doesn't amount to anything.
I know that world.
but you just keep at it. But to tell you the truth, at a certain point, probably in the early 90s, early 90s into the mid 2000s, I didn't do any music at all. And the reason, there was two reasons for that. One was that I became sort of self-conscious of the fact that I was doing this. I felt there was no real market for what I'm doing, right? Didn't make much sense. I mean, it was kind of folk rock, not really, blues, but not really blues, that kind of thing.
Sure.
Also, I was working in music theater at that moment with my collaborator, Deidre Murray. We were doing operas back then and music theater pieces. And the stuff I was doing with her, writing librettos or writing lyrics, and scripts for her for her music, seemed to be a lot more satisfying in a conversational in terms of composing than what I was doing. Me on the best day of my life cannot even get close to Deidre on the worst day of hers. So I said, you know what? This isn't bad. This isn't so bad. Maybe I should just, you know, listen to what the universe was telling me. But, you know, but that was not enough. It wasn't a good enough reason not to do it. You know what I mean? At a certain point, I suddenly realized that was not a good reason not to do it. I slowly got pulled back into my musical orbit. And realize that, and even if there isn't a market for what I'm doing, or, you know, it doesn't mean you shouldn't be doing it, right? So I've been pretty steady since 2012, 2013, right? When I sort of started up again, doing stuff on GarageBand, stuff like that, and getting some other friends together, and then I was lucky enough to run into a publisher whose name is Sammy Greenspan. She publishes a small press in outside of Cleveland and now it's in Boston and called Kelly Wampus Press. She was one of my students at the Fine Arts Work Center. It was a good workshop, and after the workshop, she invited me to be part of her chapbook series, and we talked about it and figured out that it might be good, instead of doing a regular old chapbook, that maybe, because I had enough music by then recorded, that you know, she would do a chapbook and I would do the CD attached to the chapbook. And that started off a very nice collaboration between the two of us that we still do to this day. The Memphis project, for example, is a Kelly Wampus project. You know, it's going to come out on the Kelly Wampus's logo.
Oh, so, I see. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. So that led to the formation of the band Rough Magic, and after that band fell apart, then we did that for. I was in Rough Magic longer than I was in any other band, and as a teenager, right? I mean, Rough Magic lasted about 5 years, which is twice as long as any other band I was in. You know, and then that sort of evolved into the trio right now with Charlie Rao and Lisa Liu, who are the guitarists in Rough Magic. And it's the adventure of it that I think that keeps me going now, right? The music sort of touches on a lot of different themes, right? I mean, I'm a great fan of folk and blues and, you know, that kind of thing. So you get those elements. Charlie and Lisa, play all sorts of different kinds of styles, and you can hear those styles in the way they play together. So, you know, it's not jazz, but it has some stuff in it that feels like jazz sometimes, right? And it's got stuff that again, like I said, it's blues, but it's bluesy, not blues, right? It's folky, but not folk. Maybe folkish, maybe, right? Right, and basically acoustic music. So, it's not quite Americana. Not quite, I don't know how to categorize it. I don't think it's commercial in that sense, but it's a lot of fun, you know, and I really like what we do and how we do it.
All right, so I just wanted to cut in one more time in the middle of this conversation. We're going to play one more piece from the Cornelius Eady Trio. It's a beautiful piece, I think, called Bree.
The moon goes down on the southern town. A black moon rises with the dawn. She's up the pole before the police patrol, before the dew dries on the lawn. How can she make you understand the stars and bars in Disneyland? How can she stop that silly movement in your head? How can she tune your eyes to see how black women lose, which is free? How many spikes till that beast is dead?
just before they punch. The citizens can't believe their eyes. She's whipping that flag, she's waving so free. Sweet black woman against the sun goes high. How can't you make you understand? The stars and bars and Disneyland. How can't you stop that silly movie in your head? How can't you tune your eyes and see how black woman moves when she's free? How many spikes unto the beast is dead?
One of the things that I love, you know, I've always said this for a long time, is that music, the story of music is the story of the human race, you know, and one of the beautiful things about the United States and about America is that with all these people here, at least on an artistic level, you get to see things that never existed anywhere else that suddenly sprung up because of the people together. And that's one of the most amazing things. And that leads me to some topics that I know that you really cover quite a bit in your poetry as well. And there's a lot of things about class. There's a lot of things about race, which are obviously, and you know, we're not going to be a political show. That's okay. You know, I mean, you understand, but those are some really serious issues that are at the forefront of the consciousness of our country right now. And some would argue that it's always been. Sometimes we just cover it up with pop songs saying everything's okay. But I wondered if you would speak to that a little bit. Is that why you think that was kind of such a strong theme in your work, and kind of your thoughts about if it's being addressed in art as much now as you would expect, based on, you know, your time in the art?
Well, it ebbs and flows, right? We've had, like you said, we've had times when basically, you know, all we felt like, you know, pop songs. What's wrong with pop songs, right? You know, right. I think what we are unfortunately coming to grips with again is that it never went away, right? It got suppressed. Right, but it didn't get eradicated, right? And it's one of those things that basically is now coming back to bite us again. And it seems that for the arts is the way you respond to it, right? I mean, it's a part of the way of notating and resisting, you know, the pressures, and also giving perhaps hope to people, right? I mean, I was thinking about all those great IWW Workers of the World songs back then, like Joe Hill and things like that. I mean, you know, or broadsides like Woody Guthrie's Deportes, or right?
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
You know, it's one of those things where sometimes, you know, they're the news that you spread among yourselves, right? To tell you what the newspapers aren't going to tell you, right? The certain truths about your life that you're not going to, you know, get any rhythm for in the big world, because the big world controls all the narratives, right? So you know, folk music has been very good at that, very good at delineating what it is to be human and all the different ways all the things we do to each other and all the aspirations that we want to aspire to. You know, it's a critical moment here that we're at the point where I think the very definition of the country is at risk here. Mm. I think a question that a lot of people who haven't been thinking about this are starting to think about it, being forced to think about it, is what kind of country are we? Or what kind of country have we been? Have we really been all along this very selfish, capitalist society that only cares about Darwinism, right? Is that it, right? Or this idea of this foolish, unsupportable sense of purity, right?
Right.
You know, yeah. Which is the biggest bunch of nonsense, right?
Right.
Absolutely,
that,
but deadly, because people are being killed over it, right? So it's like, you know, is that who we really were, or is that other narrative where the country is an imperfect union that is always in the process of becoming, right? Yeah. Right, you know, which is what I think a lot of us actually felt was the business of this country, right? Mm-hmm. Also, what kept us what separated us from the other cultures, right? Was that, you know, what we were aspiring to wasn't perfect, but had the protection, had the potential for this, and we had to sort of, you know, grope our way, stumble our way through, fight our way through, you know, however you want to put that, right? Right? That there was always this path that was working towards something that could be better, right? As opposed to simply saying is it simply just saying, you know, it's all been about making a buck. You know, if you don't make enough money, you're on your own. You know?
Right, right.
You know, and you deserve to be on your own, right? And we don't need the help because you failed, right? So, you know, that's the question. And I don't think the question's been that bald before, right? I mean, Trump just is stripping it down to that. Mm. You know, and it really is either on one side or the other. And a lot of people are trying to figure that out. And I think that figuring it out is also permeating into people's arts, into the arts, because the arts is where you go. You know,
exactly.
That's true.
It's where you work things out. So, you know, that conversation has always been there. You know, it's always been part of this country in one way or another, you know, either political broadsides or, you know, the different ways people are writing or, you know, it's always been there. It's always been part of the debate. And also sometimes seen as dangerous to the debate. Right. I mean, you know, because of course, you don't want people, you know, thinking.
You don't want people, right, right. Right.
You don't want the wrong people considering that they actually might have some power, that they actually might have, you know, that you know, the other people might feel the same way that they're feeling.
Right, you know? Exactly.
And,
yeah.
And you may not want them to talk, to figure it out among themselves. So sometimes the artist becomes dangerous because of that. But we have these mechanisms now in play. And I really don't know how it's gonna go. I really don't know what's gonna happen. It's really truly is up for grabs, right? It's really the great unknown. You know? Yeah. I mean, you know, what Trumpism is trying to say is that's it. This is really it, you know. And anybody else is who sort of has a different opinion is either going to be ignored, or suppressed, or exiled, you know.
Yep.
You know, from this country, it never works. It never works for long. Anybody who has a sense of the history of the world realizes it doesn't. It's never sustained. You right. can't sustain it. It never works out. But I guess it's shiny and glamorous enough that people keep going, or people think, you know, it's a short term thing and. It'll be their short term, right? I mean, they'll be, you know, maybe, you know, you can wreck things, and but it won't affect you directly. So what the hell, right? Yeah. Right? And you just keep them up, but this never works.
Yeah,
it never works. You know,
it's a fascinating kind of thing because one thing I've been seeing that I think art, poetry, music, all those things is in direct opposition to is, and it doesn't really matter even what side it's coming from, but a culture of dismissiveness of other people's thoughts and ideas.
Yes.
And that's the thing I'm seeing on a mass level. And I think the very act of creating something that is personal, that is real, is an act against that sense of dismissiveness. Yeah. And I think you're right, hitting it right on the head. I mean, there's a very, it's a spiritual existential issue that we're really wrestling with, and I feel like, and that was kind of, you know, why I asked the question, because my impression's been that it's always been there, that it's always been you know, at these issues have been there forever, and they're just kind of every now and then just kind of pushed to the side so we can watch the Super Bowl or whatever, you know. But at the same time, I think it's so important that artists are there to help, you know, help. I've noticed a lot of people who don't create who are more, it sounds more negative than I mean it to be, but they're consumers of art necessarily rather than creators of art. But a lot of times that people will do that because through the art that they're experiencing from us or from musicians or whatever, that they're accessing emotions that they have already, or they're being able to kind of process things in their own way because we're giving them access in some way, shape, or form. And I think it's so important for artists to be doing that right now. And I think that's why doing something like you're doing with teaching and all that is very valuable. So thank you for doing that. Cliff, do you have any thoughts on this stuff? We've been going off here for a bit.
No, I would love, Cornelius, do you have a poem to one of the that can encapsulate the moment, the fire that we're talking about with the political scene?
Jeez, I don't know.
And you know what? If you don't have one, I mean, because we're putting you kind of on the spot. If you have something later that you'd like to send us, or even if you don't, I can cut all this out. You know, I mean, that's totally fair. I don't want to put you on the spot too much. You know.
Well, I can tell you one. You maybe think of something. Hold on.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, I don't know if this actually fits the what we've been talking about, but. Excuse me.
Yeah, no problem.
So where is it? I thought it might not be in this book. Yeah, sure. Let me read. This is a poem about Billie Holiday, and maybe because it touches on a lot of stuff we were talking about, maybe. About art and, you know, the danger of art and the danger of the artist and stuff like that. And, you know, when Billie died here in Manhattan at Metropolitan Hospital, and she died, of course, after, you know, her rough life with, you know, drugs and alcohol and all this kind of stuff, and she was in the hospital, she was dying. The jazz lore about that moment was that she came into the hospital with her last money taped to her into her thigh, right? And there's different stories about that. One, of course, is that was all the money she had left in the world. Number two is that the way I heard it is that it was she had taped it for her pusher, right? Try to get drugs, you know, yeah. And that's why she got handcuffed to the bed when she went to her deathbed, but. One of my colleagues at Stony Brook, Roger Rosenblatt, might have another take on this. Because after I read the poem I'm about to read, Roger contacted me and said, well, you know, he told me the story. The story was that his father was a doctor. And his father was a doctor at Metropolitan Hospital. And he was there when they brought Billie in to die. And they knew she was going to die. They knew she was terminal. What Roger Rosenblatt says is that his father, seeing that she was in pain, gave her medicine. So, you know, I mean, is it someone gave her medicine, someone misinterpreted it, got the cops, you know, choose your story, right? Right,
right, right.
Right. But they all end the same way, with the cops handcuffing her to her deathbed. So this is the poem. Billie Holiday, handcuffed to a deathbed. Maybe these cops think if they can crush her soul, it will not fly. Or if there is a pearly gate, the cuffs will tip the angels. This is a low-class gal, even when she sings. Heaven as a suburb convent. Heaven as a greyhound's Mississippi backseat. Heaven, where no one drinks after a black lip sips the cup. Billie dozes, half free, and when she wakes, there's a bracelet, her wrist married to the law, to the bed, to the man that whispers, I'll never let you go. Salty gal, with your cigarette-ruined voice. Don't rise too quick. Don't rise so easy. Don't rise without heartbreak. Don't rise.
Oh, Wow. There's nothing to say, Cornelius. But beautiful.
It's
beautifully done.
I'm a chronic prefacer. I mean, this is not blind adulation here, but you know, when from your performances to, I will be short on this one. Being able to read poetry effectively, I believe, is it's a technique that must be improved upon, and just like with writing when you're younger or your whole life with different forms to find out what's out there, to see what sparks your interest, to see what else maybe you can slide and ooze into. Reading in front of people, the act of reading poetry, I believe is a vital part of you getting your poem across to people. Did you find that your ability to, when you pause and make emphasis and draw like you just did us into your poem, was that something that you adjusted and grew with over time? Is that something you practiced?
Well, not practice. It's just many years of reading poetry.
Do you ever find that you read the same poem the same way every time, or do you mix it up?
No, I don't. I don't. I mean, the written cadence will always be the same, but it doesn't mean you're obligated to read it the same way every time.
Which is great. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So Cornelius, I'm looking at the time. I want to make sure we're respecting it, but I wanted to ask some questions on behalf of, or at least a question on behalf of kind of the poets who are maybe starting out, maybe been writing for a while, but they haven't really ventured too far out with poetry, but they really want to, they feel called to do that. Yeah. And I know you spend a lot of time instructing people who are learning these things, but if you could share a piece of advice or a few thoughts, if you had the ability to share it with anybody who's listening to this, what would you tell them about living a life in poetry and taking it more seriously as part of a vocation, whether it's their main income or not?
Well, I would just tell them. I would just tell them that it's something that's going to take their entire life to do. I mean, that's what it is. I mean, to be a poet, it takes your entire life. And there's going to be things that happen as you go along. Sometimes they're good, sometimes they're bad. Sometimes, you know, they're up, sometimes they're down. But if you really have to write, nothing's going to stop you. So you probably, if you're lucky, you might be able to tell yourself, just exactly that. Nothing's going to stop you, so don't beat yourself up about why you're doing it. Because you're going to do it anyway. You're going to beat yourself up, then you're going to do it again, right?
Right.
You know, people do different things, and I can't, you know, but if I could tell somebody that, that's what I'd tell them. You know, you're going to do it. It's the thing you love the most. It's the thing that's at the core of what you do. You're just going to keep doing it. You might want to find allies along the way, and you will as you venture out there. You might want to think about how you want to be in the world, not only as a writer but as a person.
I love that. I want for people to be able to keep up with some of the projects that we've mentioned, like the Memphis Project, the poems you're sending to Sterling Brown's, the songs you're sending to Sterling Brown's poetry, or to buy your books. You know, it's so much Hard-Headed Weather, Brutal Imagination, The War Against the Obvious, Victims, you know, the latest Dance Craze. Love that title.
Yeah.
The Gathering of My Name. I got to ask this question.
Okay, sure.
When you pick, I know this might sound stupid to say, but the title of a collection, I'm good at that. The title of a book is, especially poetry, says so much. And how Hard-Headed Weather, Brutal Imagination, The War Against the Obvious, how did these titles come to you? How do you, when you, does it, well, does it come to you before the book, after the book, during the writing?
during the writer for titles, I mean, you know, I'm one of those people that I'm kind of a, you know, stickler for titles. I think the titles really cement the poem, sort of locate the poem, and also gives the reader an inkling in what they're about to come to, or give you a sense of the tone of what you might find, you know, as you go through the collection. So I'm really, you know, I mean, I've been kind of lucky with some of them. I think Victims of the Latest Dance Craze was a great title, but that was the title poem that I wrote when I was the writer in residency in my writer in residency at Sweetbriar College. So, you know, once I wrote that poem, I realized that there couldn't be another title for the book than Victims of the Latest Dance Craze or Hard-Headed Weather. Actually, that's my new and selected. And actually, tell you, sometimes I keep things in reserve. The War Against the Obvious was the original title for Hard-Headed Weather. And but by the time I finally got around to doing my new and selected, it didn't feel like the right title,
right?
Right for that collection. Mm-hmm. So I sort of put it off to the side till I finally got another opportunity to do it when J. Carr Press asked me to do a sort of a mini selected poems. And I said, well, there you go. I've got a title I've been hanging around for a while. This seems like the perfect time. For that, Gathering My Name was really good because it really was what I was up to at that moment, you know, in my life, you know, and it still feels like that was the right hit the right note for that book.
Well, we're gonna have two of your songs on this show, but I want to go back to my first question before I hit you with my second question. Okay. How do we keep up with you with the Memphis Project and then the songs being set in the Sterling Brown poems? How do we keep up with you and where that is and how we can get our hands?
I'm online a lot. I mean the trio has its own website or you know Facebook page. On my Facebook page, so you just look up Cornelius Eady Trio, and you Google it and get the email address. I'm also one of the artists for Blue Flower Arts, the artist the poet or writing representational agency. So you can contact me either through Blue Flower or you can just directly contact me through the Cornelius Eady Trio, which is just easy, you know, CorneliusEadyTrio.com, really easy to do, right?
So, yes.
So it leads to other things. We've got stuff on Bandcamp. We got stuff on there might be one or two things on iTunes. There might be things on I can't think of SoundCloud. Yes.
Yes.
All those different platforms. So you can find things. You know, you just give the search. I'm out there. We're out there.
We've done this for about 6 months, and you know, we had some really great stuff. But with this interview here, it's felt a great deal like a gospel of sorts. Oh, it's the serenity here has been something new to me to kind of just sit back and soak it in, and I can't thank you enough for that gift.
Again, thank you for inviting me. I really appreciate it.
And you'll be on the cover of the January Blue Mountain Review, and I'm stoked about that. And we've had that poem. We've had you in the magazine before with your poetry. People can check that out. It's important to me that people know about where these things are and the names of your books and stuff, because you know my word alone is, and I'm not just being overly humble. I mean, it's the truth. It's not enough to have people. They've got to go listen to it. And they've got to go read it, because what it gave me is hope and respite. And again, I cannot thank you enough for that.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
Both Cliff and I want to say thank you for spending your time with us. We also want to say thank you to Cornelius Eady for a fantastic interview. You can find out more about him and all of his projects at blueflowerarts.com. You can find Cliff Brooks at cliffbrooks.com. Also, southerncollectiveexperience.com. You can find me at michaelamide.com or worldpoetryopenmic.net. The music for this episode was provided by the fantastic Justin Johnson. You can find him at justinjohnsonlive.com. Until next time, remember to be courageous, do the hard work, conquer your obstacles creatively, learn to trust your heart, for it's easy to lose your path in this business of music and poetry.